Hello, everybody. Welcome to a new episode of Tech Can Save Us podcast brought to you by Literal Humans. As always, I am Paul David, one of your co-hosts.
And I'm Maya Darren-Paul Hornby, your other co-host.
Today, we are joined by Jojo Hubbard, the co-founder and CEO at Electron. Today, we're going to talk about flexible market platforms for decarbonization. We love some climate tech. And I don't know why I'm doing that with my hands. Maybe because of warming, global warming.
Global warming, yeah. And warming. Yeah. Not allowed to say global warming anymore.
Exactly. But we love some climate tech, and we love to talk about decarbonization on the pod. So very warm welcome to you. There I go again. Very warm welcome to you, Jojo. Welcome to the pod.
Thanks both very much for having me on.
So by way of introduction, as I said before, Jojo is the CEO and co-founder of Electron, which is a flexibility market platform that helps system operators and network utilities manage grid congestion, improve their connection rates, and lower bills. No worries, we're going to dive into that audience and describe all that to you, help you understand who system operators are, understand network utilities, and all that good stuff. Currently, just as a way of background here, the energy system is diverse and decentralized. So amidst this, flexible market platforms like Electron's, you know, they're emerging as a solution to help energy networks, or to help energy network operators, I should say, launch and coordinate multiple markets at scale. So one sort of feather in your cap there is we learned that you were recently named as one of Bloomberg's new top 25 UK startups to watch for 2024. So congratulations, Jojo.
Thank you very much. Thrilled. I also realized listening to that, what a mouthful it is. It's hard, isn't it? Like most people don't even know like where their energy comes from or how it all works, let alone have to think about what flexibility, what's a market, what's this. So let's definitely dive into that.
Yeah, so I'll give a bit of an analogy to help simplify it. So essentially, think of it like organizing a city where different people and businesses share electricity. Some make it, some use it, and some even store it. Electron creates software tools that makes sure that energy is distributed fairly and efficiently, a bit like a sort of traffic system for electricity. This helps reduce waste, save money, and make sure that everyone gets the power they need when they need it. Jojo's background is in financing renewables, specializing in solar and wind. And since co-founding Electron in 2016, she has become a co-chair of the Net Zero Council.
I should say I'm the co-chair of the SME Working Group within the Net Zero Council. The chairs are much more senior than me.
Well, what is it like working so closely with the Department for Energy Security and Net Zero?
It's brilliant and it's really important. I think there's a huge, huge ambition in the last government, even more so in this government, to get to net zero. And it was 2035, now it's 2030, and that is really incredibly hard. And people tend to think of these as kind of infrastructure transitions. But there's also a whole bunch of businesses that need to transition, and that's the voice that we're essentially bringing to the table. Like, how do you make it economically rational for a business to make these decisions, as well as, you know, like, because I think, you know, there's a certain amount of businesses will do it because it's the right thing to do. There are a certain amount of businesses who are really struggling in this economic environment. And it's about tipping incentives and making sure that the right, like, people have what they need and the right kind of new industries and businesses can keep connecting to the grid, because that's essentially how we decarbonize.
And do you feel like with those incentives, progress is materializing? Do you feel like net zero by 2030 is a sort of reasonable expectation?
Net zero by 2030 is possible. It's very expensive to do it that fast. And that's a lot of what Electron's here for. So the most kind of important, essentially valuable type of power is the power that you can, we call it dispatch. It's a power that you can say turn on or turn off. But the problem is, like, typically those have come from gas or coal, you know, the kind of thermal sites, because you can't tell, you know, wind farms produce power when the wind's blowing and solar farms produce power when the sun's blowing. But you've got this massive, massive base of, like, essentially dispatchable load coming from all these new technologies that are connecting to the grid, things like batteries, things like electric vehicles, things like, you know, any heating or cooling systems that can choose when to heat, like tanks of water, for example, can all be flexible. And so that actually is essentially the new dispatchable load. In the UK, we need around about 100 terawatt hours of it by 2030, if we are to get there that fast. And there's, you know, there's single digit terawatt hours happening now, you know, at the kind of maximum. Some people would be amazed if it were even that. And then in the US, you know, you're looking at like 1,000 terawatt hours of load growth between now and 2035. And the cheapest, the absolute cheapest, quickest to build, cleanest source of that, again, are these dispatchable batteries, electric vehicles, heat pumps, all these things. And that kind of collectively, what we call distributed energy resources, because they're not these like massive sites connected at transmission level that take 5 to 20 years to build, you know, they're essentially the things that people are adopting behind the meter, in their houses, in their businesses, or even the in front of the meter kind of investment assets like these batteries. That's the new paradigm that we're working in. And that's a really complicated paradigm, right? Because that's, you know, the kind of system operator sitting at the top used to have to speak to 200 generators. And now you've got millions of these end devices hidden behind consumer meters. Like, you need very different technology to run that energy market.
So want to give our audience some background here and just kind of break things down a little bit, as we said, simplify. Electron helps utilities and grid operators efficiently manage their distributed energy resources, or DERs, and renewable generation. So for those unfamiliar with the topic, could you just explain what DERs are and why this process specifically enhances grid stability and local renewable energy?
Sure. DER stands for distributed energy resources. An energy resource is anything that generates, stores, or consumes power typically flexibly. So it means you can choose to charge your battery at this time or charge your battery later. You can choose to heat your tank of water now or heat it later. Distributed energy resources are the ones of those that are small enough to be connected to the distribution grid. So to build on your city analogy, Maya, if you think of the energy grid as like roads, and the transmission system, which is up at the top where the, you know, gigawatt energy sites are connected to, they're all connected to motorways, and motorways have got kind of huge capacity and throughput. Whereas the distributed energy resources, that they're connected to the small roads, the B roads, they're connected to the streets, they're connected to household level. And so if you've got, you know, areas where there's a lot of solar and a lot of people have solar panels all generating at once, you get like congestion, essentially. You know, it's the same as traffic. But And that can, you know, blow something up at a local level. You know, it can cause blackouts. On the same vein, if suddenly everyone's using their charging their electric vehicle at the same time, that can suck all the power out. And then there's this kind of like nothing there, and then you get brownouts. So grid operators at a kind of distribution level at that local level, they never actually had to orchestrate or manage where or when any of these actions happened. Like, because the grid used to be this nice one-way thing, and we were sitting passively at the end of it, just waiting for the electrons to kind of come to us, you know, kind of open-mouthed. Whereas now you've got this kind of two-way power flow, and there's a need to optimize who gets power when, or you're going to start wasting clean electrons. You're going to start, like, you know, causing blackouts or brownouts in the grid, and you're just going to make it I think more than anything else, you're going to make it so insanely expensive to build all these grid upgrades that you're going to make the whole like push to net zero like completely financially inconceivable.
You kind of got into our follow-up question here, which is, you know, why do DERs need to be engaged in markets? And you mentioned kind of like the management of them. So we'd just love for you to walk our audience through that specifically.
The grid operators need a way to encourage DERs to use power at the right time and location in the grid. They've also got to give them that information, right? Like, you don't know when to charge your battery unless you're sent that. So our approach to that is market-based, which means you get price signals. So the grid operator says to you, it's super valuable right now for you to use more power because I've got an excess of it. So I will, like sometimes you can be paid to use power, you get free power. Whereas at other times in the grid, at other times and locations, typically and locations in the grid, because this can be really specific, there's just not enough to serve everyone. Mm-hmm. And you say, okay, well, the power's going to be a bit more expensive, or I will pay someone else not to use power at this time. And I think that like paying someone else not to use power instead of making the power more expensive is kind of the general push of the markets. Instead of having these tariffs that really, really spike, you know, like we saw in Texas a few years ago and things like that, it's like, can we actually find more capacity by changing the way flexible people were going to use their power then. And I think that really gets to the kind of heart of the whole promise, or like, you know, value proposition of renewables. Renewables mean like cheap, abundant power. And that sounds great. And like, who doesn't like cheap, abundant power? And everyone's like, my electricity bills are actually going up. And like, why aren't I getting the benefit of this? And it's because renewables mean cheap, abundant power, but not all the time. So you need like demand flexibility or flexible energy resources that can essentially make up for that, or partner renewables.
So when researching for this episode, I saw that in 2018, you said, if the first energy revolution was clean energy, the second energy revolution is shared data structures that anyone can build out on top of. So I was wondering, about 6 years on, is this materializing? And would you be able to position Electron within this sort of thesis?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm amazed I said that. I feel like I'm still saying that and it's a bit worrying. It's an optimization game now, right? It's no longer just about creating energy at the top and making pipes big enough for it all to flow through and down, because you've got all this like variable generation, you've got all this activity, the bottom of the grid and the distribution grid we've been talking about. So the game now is optimization, because power is abundant. Optimization is a valuable thing, and that needs data. So you need a way of seeing what's available in the grid, like what's available generation-wise. You need ability to see what's available kind of grid capacity-wise. You need the ability to influence that, so to talk to some of the inherent flexibility that the companies like, you know, OVO, Octopus, Flextricity, people who can do those kind of turn ups, turn downs, and so much more, right? In this kind of world of AI and machine learning, you can see how that world kind of keeps going. And actually, you can start having those energy assets like representing themselves with a kind of autonomous agent who knows that their person living there needs power bought before this time and is, or can sell flexibility under these circumstances and is trying to make the best decision for them. So essentially, it's kind of data now that's becoming the really valuable thing to power the system effectively, because that will unlock kind of abundant, clean electricity. You know, a single megawatt hour isn't worth anything if it comes in the wrong time and location in the grid. It's actually going to create more cost to manage.
And so could you sort of position Electron in relation to the sort of like collection and visualization of that data?
Great question. So Electron is essentially almost like the kind of communications pipe between the parties operating the grid as to where and when they need people to use more power or less power, with all the people controlling the energy assets or the distributed energy resources themselves. And we operate very much on this kind of open data ecosystem. We build a lot of open data tools. We're building one now for the industry around data portability for people registering their energy assets and their company's identities on our markets. How can you port that across to other platforms? And it's essentially all one big coordination game. And it's the question is like, how do you get everyone to speak the same language and use the same data tools and call the same things, the same names? And that's a huge piece in scaling this market.
And in terms of the sort of like, yeah, consistency of terminology and metrics and all of that, how do you go about organizing that?
It's tricky, right? Because there's a lot of pieces and there's a lot of actors, and this industry loves a like consultation group and a, you know, 4-year process to build out the perfect data tool. You know, we're an industry full of engineers and we all believe there's a perfect answer. I think the challenge is that perfect answer changes every year, and the industry changes every year, and it just takes such a long time to find it. So we try to do it quite pragmatically, to stand on the shoulder of giants and pick up, you know, any standards or any work someone else has already done, to try and like, you know, make sure we're like in those conversations, or at least a funnel for them, and then essentially build something that's fundamentally useful for the markets we're operating today. That solves the kind of challenge for today and do it in a way that it can be kind of, you know, it can evolve or be upgraded or be added to as more and more exists. But there is also a lot of our, you know, a lot of our work that's captive to the standards we inherit. You know, when someone else has done standards and said, okay, if you register an asset, you need to enter, you know, information into these 50 data fields, then we need information in these 50 data fields. You know, we can kind of put our hand up and say, you know, 50% of the markets only need 20 of them to be filled out. But this is an industry that's all about coordination that has to work with one another. And I think it's just finding the right use cases to mean that you can do something real as opposed to like sit around a table for a few years.
Love the point you made about, you know, the standards we inherit and like the, you know, folks in the industry sitting around the table and how they love like a committee and a, you know, discussion, things like that. Talk to us about the landscape for this transformation. Who are your frenemies in this work? What do the big energy providers have to say about your insurgent efforts here?
It's interesting because I think there was a feeling of us versus them when we first started, you know, that was 9 years ago. The energy transformation story has just become like the story of and we need this and, you know, and even, you know, there's even a kind of increasing role for gas, particularly with Trump in now kind of coming back into the system, you know, because gas is flexibility. So, you know, when we kind of started, we were like, okay, you need clean flexibility, you need to get rid of dirty flexibility. But fundamentally now, you just need flexibility, like really, really, really fast, and almost more than anyone can build, you know, from kind of either tech. The large energy producers, if they want to install and build new clean energy plants, they need more, you know, flexible energy users. So like this is a highly kind of I guess that the point of these markets is group efforts, right, is to discover what is the kind of most economical, what is the best allocation of resource across a very, very complicated system? That's what markets do. And it's no different for us.
So has your thinking around this shifted, like around how to be flexible and what to be flexible on?
For flexibility or like to be mentally flexible and to involve industries clean or dirty?
The former, like more, like you mentioned gas specifically. Yeah. I mean,
gas is the OG of flexibility. It's the reason why demand side flexibility didn't exist because we had generation flexibility. You know, I think when people think of, you know, flexibility as a niche industry, they forget just how much flexibility today we rely on the generation side. I'm a kind of pragmatic idealist. Like I believe that, you know, essentially distributed energy resources are the fastest, cheapest way to get this flexibility. People are already buying them and installing them for different reasons. So, you know, on any maths, they outcompete, you know, new build gas at least rationally. But the issue is they're not in the market. So like we see the job to be done for us is to just make it, you know, lower the friction and the barriers to entry for everyone to want to sign their batteries and their cars up to earn money for them when they don't need the capacity for anything else. So we really want to lower those barriers to entry. We need to find more value. We need to help network utilities work out like what it's really worth for them for an asset to change the way it's planned to use the grid. And it's huge. These are people who are spending, you know, billions of dollars on grid upgrades over the next, you know, 3 to 5 years. If you can, you know, just a couple of percentage of points of capital efficiency is incredibly valuable in terms of just which bit of grid they should build next and which bits can be held up for flexibility next. So lower the friction, create more value, and then use that to drive more volume. You know, the more you get paid for putting your assets up to be part of this market, firstly, the more people are likely to bring their flexibility to market. Secondly, the cheaper you make it to finance those assets. You know, you've got a forward curve, you've got an expectation of what revenue they can earn, so you can get that off the cost of the asset. Then more people buy batteries or whatever, and then you drop the cost to buy it. And it's this really amazing virtuous circle, which is like really the only way you get to something of the kind of scale of the transformation we need. And those, you know, that net zero by 2030 is looking very, very close. Like the only way it's doable is if this scale really, really starts kind of transforming.
And in terms of, yeah, that sort of forecasting, you began Electron in 2016. And with the rise of AI, how has that been integrated into Electron's work, particularly in that sort of predicting?
Yeah, it's a really interesting question. We use AI like internally mainly for productivity at the moment. I believe that like there is a important role for AI in these markets in the future, but I think there's also like a, and you know, particularly on the kind of trader end of it, but there's also this big group of people who think that actually AI is going to be infinitely, you know, knowledgeable and is going to solve all of the issues of where and when power should flow in a grid, as essentially no more than the people who are operating the energy assets. So you don't have a market anymore. You have like one central intelligence saying power goes here, 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 here. And it's just not how any of even like the kind of like any of the other markets have advanced, because like they're missing this essentially fact that AI needs data to make good decisions, you know, and you know, and a lot of the data around what would someone do if you offered them this price? What would someone do if you offered them that price? Like, what would someone do if you created a market structure in this way? That data doesn't exist yet until you essentially, you know, run the markets. So we believe there's a huge role for us to kind of partner that intelligence with the new data that we're surfacing by running the market as to like how people will behave under these circumstances, like what will happen under these circumstances. We see it as like a kind of, huge future potential. But really, this industry is still just trying to bring a lot of these data and assets to market today.
Yeah, and so important to sort of see your role as providing the future infrastructure for those sort of AI-powered solutions. Yeah, hopefully solutions that will be powered by an AI that itself is a lot more, you know, a lot less energy guzzling.
It's a really interesting question. So AI is kind of interesting for a future piece of our product. It's also really interesting as the kind of future piece of our grid. As you say, it's so incredibly data hungry. But, you know, we're also in a world where you can have abundant, clean power if you use it at the right time and locations. There's this huge need to make data centers or to bring data centers into this kind of concept of flexibility markets. We've looked at some really interesting projects around this, like a lot, you know, the ones who are trying to power themselves with all green power have too much power most of the time, almost all the time, right? And then need to actually like buy flexibility. They want to encourage people locally to use that excess power because they're not going to be able to inject it all into the grid unless they have like the grid connection that everyone's been fighting about. And then maybe on some really, really rare events, they might not have enough. And then they're going to rely on that community who've been flexibly consuming power from them to essentially provide some spare capacity back. Like we think some of these data centers could actually be these kind of epicenters of these new almost micro markets. But they're really forcing a question like faster. Well, you know, when you've got all this load growth coming on, so we're going to consume a lot more power in the future than you are today, how are you going to build the system out to accommodate that? And it still comes down to the fact that like distributed energy resources are the cheapest, fastest way to get that, you know, additional grid capacity back. But we just got to start adopting the kind of technologies like ours that helps it scale.
Want to pivot us a little bit, and we'd be remiss as a growth agency, as a marketing agency, we didn't ask a few questions about growth and about fundraising and marketing, obviously. So want to take us there. In January of this year, it was announced that you'd raised $5 million to support your growing team to, you know, invest in further product development and to scale specifically in North America. So we'd just love to understand, like, 1 year on, you know, how has it gone with your growth strategy? How are you and Emma and Abby and Suzanne, your marketing team, how are you thinking about leveraging or continuing to leverage that raise to achieve that scale and really, you know, catalyze and push forward that growth?
Yeah, we're really, really excited about the US story as well. Some of our team are moving across and we're building a bigger team there from early next year. Ours are long, slow sales cycles. They're very sticky, but it takes a very, very long time to like teach someone how to operate differently and for them to teach us how they operate today and to kind of build those things together. So you know, the first sale can be anything from kind of 9 to 18 months. And I say we're well into those first sales cycles. So some, you know, hope to have some quite exciting things to announce next year. But the US story is fascinating. Next to the UK, I mean, UK went first on building distribution grid level markets and is kind of world leading on that. But, you know, everything's bigger in the US, as you guys know. Each household uses three times as much power as the average UK household. The load growth, and especially from data centers, is more than three times, you know, higher, even like on a per capita basis. And so we think there's huge, huge, huge potential in that market and are quite excited. I also think that a lot of the challenges we've been facing here, you know, this kind of siloed data sets and like different people trying to pay these distributed energy resources to do different things without having any coordination between them. Like those transpose very nicely. The product market fit was much closer than we had understood it to be when we first started looking at that market. So yeah, we are bullish on that and really, really excited about that transformation story. Even under Trump, you know, the key things that the US is trying to, you know, counter it, like energy affordability, like that's exactly what we do. It's like economic efficient, you know, allocation, you know, reshoring, is essentially like domestic power and energy security. You know, this is homegrown. These are homegrown megawatts or negawatts. I think it's still bang on theme.
And would love to hear a bit more about how you work to kind of localize your marketing strategy to the unique nature of the US audience. Like what have you learned about the key differences between the US audience and the UK audience?
We talk a lot about resiliency in the US that we don't really talk about in the UK, because in the UK, you know, power is, you know, it's incredibly rare to have power cuts. Whereas in some areas, we're in the US, you know, with more extreme weather or with different types of grids, like, you know, it might be very normal to have like, you know, a week or two without power a year, which is like almost unthinkable here. So like, you know, resiliency is a big theme. The way that kind of communities interact with power around kind of affordability and equity, whereas it's, you know, it's affordability and now it's not, we don't say equity anymore. So like it's also, you know, the US, as you know, is 50 different states with 50 different state regulators in energy. So it's definitely no one size fits all. I think areas that have moved faster on like clean tech adoption have already done a lot of this work for us, and you know, we can learn how they're talking about energy and speak the same language. But then there are some things that actually mean different things on one side, you know, some acronyms that mean different things on one side of the water to the other, and that's funny. It's like the two countries separated by a common language.
Yes, as a Yank who runs a marketing agency in the UK, I'm keenly aware of that. I think I regret my overestimation of the similarities when I initially arrived, and have been reminded every day of the differences. So
you must have some good stories.
Definitely appreciate that for another time over a pint and a pub, I'm sure. and you mentioned that some of your team have moved over there. So just curious about how you've been able to kind of marshal the right resources to build that growth in the US. Have you brought on outside support? Are you just shipping folks over there? How has it all come together for you?
Yeah, no, it's a mix. I think one really nice thing about this industry is because it's so kind of consultative is you get very good opportunities to meet great people. You know, so there's a lot kind of through our own network we've been able to do. You know, we're pushing a lot of kind of like a lot of stories about what works here. There's a really receptive audience. You know, at the kind of highest, even the federal level, for like the UK learning stories, because, you know, let's not repeat anyone else's mistakes. That would be crazy. And UK definitely went first on the kind of grid services market structure and setup. But yeah, it's brilliant own network. There's a couple of brilliant networks out there that we can tap into. I don't want to start naming them because I know I'm going to miss the other ones out.
Before the show, we talked a little bit about your kind of push to resist that restrictive naming of fundraising rounds. So yeah. I'd love for you to just say a bit more about that. You mentioned publicity, kind of where is that coming from? And how do you think that shows up for you know, small but mighty startups like yourselves?
Well, you asked at the beginning, what name did we give to our last round? we left it nameless. I think that some of these labels can not serve the companies that have raised in a certain stage. There are some companies that, you know, started a few months ago and have a PowerPoint deck and raise hundreds of millions, especially if you're an AI at the moment. And there are some companies that have been, you know, really like fundamentally running for years and years, doing important things that are very capital efficient, that are raising, you know, $3 to $5 million and so it's not really about like what's the name of the last round, and the push we usually find for that is actually more the, like, you know, the when you want to announce your round, like people want to announce it with a letter. I think the important thing in the next funding round is like find people who invest in the kind of stage that you're at with the kind of revenue profile that you're that you're pushing after. So we did not name our last round, and I think it's also in respect to the fact that like the names look very different depending on which side of the Atlantic you're on, from the kind of stages. And I would encourage many companies or founders to do similar, because there's a kind of feeling when you've just done it, you know, you're kind of on top of the world and you can kind of give out that kind of racy statement and put the letter as high as you can, but then you can cut off some people who'd be fantastic investors for you later, or attract people who just simply can't invest based on where you are at that stage. And that is a huge time suck for founders. You know, it's a lot of time where you're not putting into your company's growth.
Yeah, it strikes me that like you mentioned publicity, like it's kind of almost a function of, you know, like the news media having to like box people into like certain, yeah. You know, like they need categories to, so that they can structure things for their articles and stuff like that. It's really fascinating.
People don't understand what your company does. Just tell me what box to put you in.
Yeah. Going to get a lot of ads. Good thing I'm not on X, but like, you know, like journal, I think there's a, like some, you know, laziness, I think, to in the journalism profession. I say this as a former freelance journalist, but like, you know, just put them in this box and it's here. And like, unless you go really deep and really understand what a lot of these startups do, you know, you'd quickly learn, hey, that is not the same as that. And I shouldn't be putting them in this box and things like that. So,
It's not a laziness. It's just like, everyone's under so much mental load at the moment. It's like so much. So many different startups come from so many different places, and then everything else. Like you can see the thing. It's more like you want someone to filter things for you, and you want to know when to like stop listening. And so I think if you give a name too early and it's the wrong name, you can lose the right listener.
Yeah, that's a much more charitable, kinder way of referring to it. But I'm gonna stick to my guns on that. Yeah, I'm gonna hear a lot from a lot of tech journalists who, we'll see.
The notion of giving something the wrong name too early, so losing a potential listener, leads me on very nicely to my question about the phrase net zero. I heard that you didn't really like this for it being a negative framing of what should really be a positive set of new opportunities. I was wondering if you could speak on the importance of language and positive framing in relation to energy transition and perhaps the climate crisis more broadly.
Yeah, totally. Net zero sounds like we're trying to drive something out, but drive something down. And you know, essentially, we're trying to use as less carbon as possible. Not just because of the carbon, like that's not like that's one piece in it, and that's definitely an imperative. But like, I think the economic imperative, like fundamentally, renewables are the cheapest form of power we've got, and distributed energy resources are the cheapest form of flexibility we've got to use that power at the right time. And I think that's a really, really important. Really, really, really important like statement. It's a really important thing that has to be true to get the investment that we need to drive down our use of carbon. And so it's not just this focus on like what should happen, but focus on the incentives, like what is economically rational, and then use regulation to like tilt the board so the economically rational thing, to make the thing that's right to achieve is now also economically rational. I think the energy abundance story of renewables is still just being lost because people like net zero is the buzzword. Like this idea that you can have like, you know, cheap power or like, you know, zero marginal power essentially forever is so important to us. And like that's the reason we're doing it. And then people instantly go, well, the sun doesn't, you know, shine and the wind doesn't blow all the time. And like, that's what flexibility does. You know, that's what batteries and electric vehicles and your electric water heaters and everything can do. You know, when you couple that with intelligence, when you couple that with markets, when you couple that with the right data infrastructure, you get this really exciting, abundant world, abundant intelligence, abundant work you can do on the back of that abundant power. And you know, and we're sitting there going like, all these data centers are going to use a lot of energy, but like we have a lot of energy coming, you know, out of the sky and in the wind, and you know, if we can use the right energy in the right way, I think that the story should be about economic transformation. Like, what new industries can we run in a world where power is incredibly cheap almost all the time? It transforms the unit economics of things like vertical farming that need a lot of light, but not all the time. You know, like strawberries are happy to stop growing when it's dark, when it's nighttime. You grow the strawberries when there's more wind, stop growing the strawberries when there's not. You know, it's a lot of these like synthetic protein productions and like desalination plants for salts. Like, you know, the next big challenge after energy is going to be food and clean water, and like abundant, cheap energy can solve a lot of those challenges. So I think there's often a very negative framing to this net zero, and everyone comes in and goes, oh, I don't know if we want to do this. Like, why would we want to put all this extra cost in our industry? And then I'm sort of looking at them and I'm like, but if all the other countries are running their industry on like essentially zero marginal cost, abundant power, like how is your industry going to compete with theirs? So it's just really, really understanding, like, we're here for the opportunity of this, not just, you know, not just because it's the right thing. It's the right thing to do. You know, essentially, you know, we're for profit. Like, we think this is economically rational and we want to make it more economically rational. And we want other people to be able to make a profit in it, because that is how you like adopt all these clean energy technologies at scale.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I love that. And I bet in 8 years' time, you're going to have somebody else come to you in an interview and ask you all about the abundance of food production and water production.
I hope so.
Well, great. Well, Jojo, this has been an awesome conversation. Thank you so much for jumping onto the pod. We really appreciate your time. We know you're busy trying to, you know, save the world, save energy markets, and get people, you know, redistributing their energy in more effective, more efficient ways.
Not save. I'm not one of the...
Change.
Make,
evolve.
Improve.
Yeah. I'll soften it. My American, I'm bombastic, you know, sorry about that. But yeah, maybe let listeners know where they can learn more about you and your great work at Electron.
We're on electron.net. We put out a lot of stuff on LinkedIn. That's our kind of main channel. So yeah, find us Electron or Electron Grid, because we chose quite a common name. If you want to know more, yeah, we look.
I saw the .net. That's old school. I like that. The shout out.
.net. We really had a long conversation about it. It's mainly because we can't afford .com. Millions.
Very flexible decision. Well, for our audience, just a big thank you to Jojo. Please give Jojo a shout out. Thank you for jumping on the pod. Please leave a review, 5-star rating. Please, helps us get amazing guests like Jojo Hubbard onto the pod. And yeah, this has been another great episode of Tech Can't Save Us podcast. Signing off, I'm Paul David, one of your co-hosts. Thank you so much, Jojo.
Thank you so much, Paul and Maya.
Thank you.